Astonishing Legends Network.
Hello, everyone. The moment has arrived. Susan and I are packing up our merch and hitting the road tomorrow. 6 cities in 7 days. They said it couldn't be done. Actually, they said it shouldn't be done, and they were right. But we're doing it anyway. God, I'm already tired. Look, here's the thing. The performances are no problem. That's the fun part. It's everything leading up to the moment I start. That's the hard part. You know, you must have heard that rock bands and musicians say, they pay me to travel, I sing for free. That is exactly right. That's exactly how I feel. The traveling on this one is going to be brutal. My fault. But the show's going to be great. So if you are anywhere near Toronto, Minneapolis, Chicago, Cleveland, or Pittsburgh, you should definitely try to make it to one of the shows, because I don't know when I'm going to be cruising back through the beautiful Midwest again. And if you really want to check something off your bucket list, come and see me in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Susan and I will be at the Mothman Festival at a table within spitting distance of Mothman's ass. And let me tell you, that's where you want to be. We're going to have custom merch. We're going to have signed scripts. I'm going to be doing 2 shows that day on the Saturday, the 19th, but the big one is Saturday night. And then that's it. And then we're back home, and it's back to work, writing the show. I crawl back into my hole and refuse to socialize with anyone until Christmas Eve. That's just how it is. It's totally normal. Now, today's guest is the brilliant, funny, and charming Peter Laws. Peter and I have been friends for years now. I have no idea how or why it happened. Isn't that the best kind of friendship? It's just there, like it was somehow always there. Peter's the guy I want to be when I grow up, even though he's way younger than me. First of all, he's an author. Okay, he created the Matt Hunter series, which, and by the way, who doesn't want to read about a guy named Matt Hunter? In the Matt Hunter series, Matt Hunter is an ex-church minister who's lost his faith, dropped out, and now assists the police in solving religiously motivated crimes. Because, you know, those happen. Seriously, is there a premise more perfectly suited for me? I am actually so angry that Peter created this character before I could. But that's okay. I enjoy that he did all the hard work. These books, they're seriously creepy. They're really scary. They're super fun. They're really the perfect kind of book for me, probably you too. But that's not all, because he himself is a reverend, ex-reverend. I think he is still officially a reverend. Maybe that's not something you ever stop being. But anyway, it's not how he makes his living anymore. Now he has an insanely popular YouTube channel called Into the Fog, where he investigates and documents true, terrifying reports of the unexplained. These are real cases, and he talks to the people who lived through them. The cases are real, they're not fiction, and many have never been told before, so if you're looking for something to kick off the fall season and get you into that Halloween mood, Into the Fog is just what you're looking for. So today, Peter and I talk about everything from our favorite horror films to Ouija boards to Peter's own supernatural encounters. And along the way, we grapple with the pressing questions. Is there an afterlife? Which religion believes in ghosts the most? Should you take your grandfather to see Friday the 13th Part 4? Is Taylor Swift a witch? Is E.T. a demon? And just what does Peter mean when he says that his books are literally flying off the shelves? Well, only one way to find out. Here we go. All right, dude, we're on. I think this is it. I think we're talking to each other professionally
yes,
now.
Yes, this does look good. I can hear you. I can see you. I'm feeling good about this.
Can you see how I've got this weird like beam of sunlight
yeah.
on me?
You know what it's reminding me of? I just recently showed my kids The Omen, the original Richard Donner, and it's given me like Omen vibes, this line across you. So I hope you'll right. watch out for yourself in the next
yeah.
few days.
I'm going to stay away from trucks delivering large panes of glass.
Yeah, as long as you do that, you'll be fine.
God, remember The Omen? Remember back when that's what a horror movie was?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, The Omen, I watched it recently and then wanted to show my kids it. And we have this kind of tradition on my birthday or on like Father's Day. The biggest gift I can get is just to say, I'm going to force you to watch whatever film I want to watch.
100%. 100%. Yeah. I am so with you on that.
Absolutely. So, you know, I've made them watch Dario Argento's Suspiria and then Stephen King's Silver Bullet. And then we went on to The Omen. Yeah, I know, Silver Bullet. And then I went on to The Omen. And yeah, watching it back, I was really struck by how solid it still is, the scares and the themes that still seem like particularly relevant. So yeah, I was really impressed with it. It feels like proper horror, because there's moments where I'm like, oh my goodness, this is freaking me out. And I've seen it so many times, so it's great.
Well, okay, you say proper horror. And then how do you like how would you compare that to horror movies that are coming out now? Like, what is it? Obsession is a big one, right?
Yeah.
Like right now and Backrooms. But I mean, which I don't know if you've seen, and I barely even know what that is. I'm talking about titles. I don't even know what the hell I'm talking about. But what's like, what is the change you're seeing?
Well,
if you're seeing one.
I wouldn't necessarily say there's an objective change, because I really do believe that people view everything through nostalgia. And so it's merely because I saw these films at such a young age, these older films, that they contain a kind of baked in experience that unlocks when I watch them again. So really, it doesn't have any bearing on whether or not the film is great or not, because I can watch like really old, like crappy like horror movies from when I was a kid, Zoltan, Hound of Dracula, and I'd be like loving this. Yeah. And it's not necessarily baked into the film, it's baked into me. So yeah, I've seen Obsession. I really liked Obsession. I think I'm not a big fan of saying like modern horror and old horror are at loggerheads with each other, but I'm pretty confident that people, when they hit 50 or 60, they'll be looking back on films today and have this similar nostalgic rush.
But isn't that weird? I try to believe that, but I'm like, I'm doing my old man thing, but it's like, are teenagers now really going to look back at this time and go, God, that was so great.
Yeah.
2026.
Yeah. I think they probably will, but then, having said that, there are some films that just seem to stand the test of time. And one great way of discovering whether or not horror films continue to be effective is to watch reaction videos on YouTube. And I really enjoy watching those, where people, particularly young people, will just watch these films for the first time, and you'll see them, you know, experience them in a way that unlocks your own memories of it, but also shows, oh, this still stands up today. This is still freaking them out.
I love that. Okay, so how many kids do you have?
Two.
And how old are they?
14 and 17.
Oh my God. Okay, so this is like perfect. Okay.
Yeah.
Is one of them more into it than the other one?
Yeah, well, one of them, my daughter, is really into cinema and into film. So she has a particular interest in that sort of thing. Whereas my son, he likes that as well. But for her, I think she like thinks about films, and I'll walk in and she'll be watching some like obscure role film. And she reminds me of myself when I was a teenager, you know, seeking out, you know, like really weird art films or, you know, just things that, when I look back at myself as a teenager, I sometimes go, well, I'm kind of pleased that I had the patience to watch some of that stuff, because it wasn't very mainstream.
But then I was consuming, like, I think it's different. I think when you're younger, I mean, I would meet a movie, I would meet an author more than halfway. You know, I was ready to sit down, I'd read some book that nowadays I would get 50 pages into, if that, and go, no, this isn't doing it for me. Nah, throw it away. Back then it was like, no, I must consume and sponge up everything. Cause that's, you know, what you want to do when you're a teenager.
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes back to my point about how because you see them for the first time, and when you're young, you have all of these like experiences and reactions getting unlocked for the first time. And so because you've had them unlocked so many times since, then if you watch a film today, sometimes you might not get that same buzz. But it's not necessarily about the film itself.
No.
It's about that experience getting open, going, oh my goodness, I never realized I was frightened of the idea of a dog biting my teeth out. Like, I've never even thought about that before. Now I've watched a film where that happens. That's a new fear unlocked. So that's why I do think watching these films, I remember I went to the cinema with my grandfather to watch Friday the 13th Part 4. It was just an amazing experience. Not necessarily an amazing film. I liked it, but there was something about seeing it with him in a cinema. And I just think all of these things we bring to the films and the stories that we consume, which is why I tend to be a little bit like, I heard Steven Spielberg the other day saying, I've never seen a film that I didn't find something good in. And it tends to be the same with me.
Well, I mean, that's a great feeling. I totally believe he said that. I want to talk about your grandfather. You went with your grandfather? Was he really into movies? Like, did he you into the experience? Or
No, I kind of shepherded him into that singular experience, because we went to a holiday camp. There's this holiday camp in the UK called Butlins. And when I was a kid, we used to go to these places and they had a cinema. And usually you would be seeing all of the normal, like The Goonies or Indiana Jones. And I just spotted, wait a minute, that's Jason Voorhees on the poster. And I would have been too young for it, but they let me in. I remember when I went to see Poltergeist 2, The Other Side, for the first time. And there was a 15 certificate in the UK. And the woman at the counter said to all of my friends, are you over 15? We weren't. Are you over 15? And they all said, yes, we are. Yes, we're 16. I'm 17. And she let them all in and got to me. Are you over 15? And I had this crisis of conscience. I said, I'm not. I'm 14 or whatever I was. And she said, oh, you know what? Because you've been honest, you can go in. So she let me into this like illegal film anyway. But then in the UK as well, because I was really into VHS, we were one of the, if not the first family in our town to get a VHS player. I was also around at a young age getting what they called the video nasties, the before certification hit in the UK. It was just a wild west of gore for films. And so the local video store would say, you know, oh, we've got this stuff under the counter. Do you want to see Cannibal Holocaust? And I might be like 10 or something, like probably too young. But I watched it anyway and loved it.
And were you, I mean, so were you the one in your family who did that? Did your parents, were they like, what is going on with this kid?
Yeah, yes. I was like the one who loved horror more than anyone else, although they would watch stuff. And I remember my dad once telling me that when he went to see the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre in the 70s and came home, and my mom said she saw him come in and he was physically shaking when he was talking about it. And I just thought, I want that. That's the feeling. I want to go to a story in which I'm safe, but that I come feeling that I'm totally unsafe for a few hours. And so, yeah, I had this feeling of kind of seeking stuff out that was not only like fun and interesting, but also disturbing or scary. And it wasn't even that I enjoy, I mean, that's the point, I suppose, of my life in some ways. I'm quite scared of death. I'm disturbed by all of these themes. I find it quite frightening. And so I don't go to see these films or write these books or read these stories to gloat about suffering or anything like that. It's really the opposite. I find it a way of dealing with my own fears.
Well, okay, let me take a slight step back. Some people, and at times in my life, I have been like this. My interior world is so anxious.
Yeah.
And sort of like, you know, I've got a very high idol at times in my life, that having a stressful exterior in a way, mm-hmm. like there have been times where I've walked into, you know, the haunted maze, you know, or some haunted house that someone has set up, where the kind where people are jumping out at you and things are, you know, coming right at you. And I just feel so relaxed. I'm just like, oh, finally, I have a zombie screaming at me and holding a, and But it always felt like it's because there's a balance now between my interior state and and an exterior state. And I've heard other people say that, you know, I'm like, I hate Hawaii. It's too relaxed, you know?
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, it doesn't make me relaxed. It makes me even more anxious. I need to balance those things out. Yeah. Is that part of what you experience?
Well, not with me, because I also really love relaxing. So, I mean, I do enjoy just like sitting by a swimming pool, you know, drinking a pina colada and just kind of watching the world go by. So I like that. And so I guess I'm balanced in that way. But I think the thing for me was, particularly when I was at school, there was something in me that was asking very big questions that maybe some of my other friends didn't appear to be. You know, they would talk about football, or they talk about, you know, Knight Rider or the A-Team. I loved all that sort of stuff. but as well as that, I was like, yeah, but, you know, could there be like life after death? Or like, are we alone in the universe? Do aliens actually exist? Like, is there such a thing as good and evil? But I wasn't interested in religion, which was ironic, because I ended up becoming a church minister at one point, but that was later. But religion didn't offer me a version of that was appealing, because it was so locked down to particular expressions, and it had a lot of rules with it, not least don't watch horror films because that's bad for you. Don't listen to minor chord music or heavy metal or whatever. And I'm like, oh, well, that's not for me. So I found myself moving into the world of horror and the paranormal and ghost stories and all that sort of stuff, because what that did was, it, as well as give me a space in which to explore my fears, it unlocked an enchanted world literally on my doorstep. It would, and I love movies where there's just a person in a town that, and this is like Silver Bullet's a good example of this, where just a kid in a wheelchair doing his thing, and then suddenly he gets to realize that people are getting murdered by a werewolf in town, and then he gets sucked into this adventure, and it's a scary adventure. I love the idea that me as a kid could potentially have one of those adventures on the doorstep. For example, maybe not a werewolf, but if the house up the road was haunted, then I literally would have an access point to a cosmic doorway to another way of being. And that just turns all of the colors up of life, I think. And so I think maybe I was like on a quest to discover if I wasn't alone. Maybe that's why I loved E.T. so much, the idea of an alien coming and connecting with me. Maybe loneliness was part of it. I don't know.
So in as your life has gone on, have you had personal experiences that have sort of paid that off, where you've gone, oh, and now I have seen that other side?
Yeah, I've had experiences that I wouldn't say I'm 100% able to say without a shadow of doubt, because I'm so open-minded, it kind of gets annoying, but I'm so open-minded that I always, even if I was to see you know, a ghost right in front of me right now, you know, it's possible that it's in my head, you know, I'm just imagining it. So I have had experiences, and funnily enough, the older I've gotten, I've had a few more experiences, and the more convincing they have been. And so really, even though I'm kind of sometimes on the fence, I lean towards belief. I've always leaned towards belief, and then went through a period of maybe leaning more to the middle. But in the last, 5 years or so, I find myself leaning much more towards belief, and just experiences that I've had, but also people I've spoken to who've told me their experiences.
I've definitely talked to people, but I've never had an experience of my own. Do you want to share one of the experiences that you had recently?
I'll share one that happened to me recently, where I was speaking in Massachusetts in the U.S. and went over, this was a couple of Halloweens ago, and I was put up in a place called Quesit House, which is this beautiful New England mansion that's in Easton in Massachusetts. And they have, you should check this out, Richard, because they have this author in residence program where they basically say, if you want to come and you can stay for 30 days for the whole month in this mansion, if you want, you can have the third floor. All we ask is, you know, do a few talks and you can stay there. So I'm like, oh, that sounds amazing. And I wanted to visit Providence, and I want to visit Salem and all these other things. And so so came over for that. But on the first evening when I went there, I was quite scared about staying at the place because I was going to be there alone. And if me and you are together and we see something, that's way more attractive to me, because then you and I can say, I saw it too. And then it takes away the worry that I saw it in my own mind. But because I'm on my own, I'm like, well, I could have a full-on paranormal experience in this place. And it's either going to make me convinced of the supernatural, or it's going to make me think, wow, I really am teetering on the edge of insanity, because if there's no, do you know what I mean? So that's why I love to do things with other people. And this was actually quite scary. So instead of staying for 30 nights, I'm like, well, I'll be out there for, say, almost 2 weeks. And I'm going to stay in hotels, and I'm going to stay in places. And then I'll do 3 nights in this place. So I did. And on the first night, they put me in the top floor. I was lying in bed. And it was because I was freaked out and scared, I kept the lights on. And I didn't have my hire car at that point. So I was a little bit worried about not being able to escape if something did come in the room or whatever. But I'm like, hey, chill out. Don't be daft. But then I fell asleep. And then while I was asleep, I felt some hands grasping around my ankles. Now, I've never had a sleep paralysis experience, but who knows? Maybe this is what it is. But there's more to this that makes me think it wasn't. I felt these fingers go around my ankles, grip them, and then start bouncing my legs up and down on the bed quite violently. I've never read about that happening anywhere. And it was so crazy that, and I was so freaked out that I woke up, but I kept my eyes shut tight because something was bouncing me up and down and up and down. And anyway, I eventually was like, I'm going to have to look at this. I'm going to have to look. And I did. And I opened my eyes and, you know, classic horror movie scene. There's nothing there. But I'm kind of breathless and thinking, but wait, I am awake. And I've been awake freaking out about this. And then a little while later, as I was contemplating all this, the side of the bed started to sink. The mattress on my right started to sink down. And I could feel like somebody rolling onto me. And I'm just like sitting there going, I've heard people tell me these stories, right? And I always go, oh, you're in bed. Yeah, you're dreaming. But I've had so many vivid dreams in my life. Okay. But like this was a different level of reality, like 4K UHD. And I feel this thing rolling onto me and I just kind of freak out. And then anyway, it goes away. And then the next morning I run over to the library because it's the library that put up the authors, and I'm like sprinting over, get to the library, push open the double doors, and I'm panting. I go to the counter and I just say, you're not going to believe what happened last night in the room. And before I started to tell them, they said, well, what time did it happen? And I'm like, oh, like, well, 3 a.m. And then the woman said, well, you need to go back and you need to find the journal that's written by the authors who stay there, because you're not the only one who's had this type of experience. And sure enough, I rush back over, I eventually find this journal, and other authors who stayed in that particular room had similar experiences at 3 a.m. where something had come in. And I didn't know about these things. I deliberately tried to avoid learning the stories, not through any kind of trying to be independent judge. I didn't want to freak myself out because I was quite scared because I was there alone. And so seeing this sort of thing was a different kind of level of experience, which was quite frightening at the time. But then later when I was out and I decided I've got to make a YouTube video about this. And again, you think, oh, people out there are going to think this is all just a story for a YouTube video. And you're always conscious of that.
Right.
But I'm like, but it's not. It's like this really happened. So I make this YouTube video. And while I'm filming it, a historian turns up because he's doing a show of the apartment, an old 60s film. And I talked to him about it. And he said, well, in that room, I don't know if you realize, but you're overlooking the pool where the child drowned, because the child of the family drowned and they covered it up, and that's why it's all bricked up. And they talk about a child sometimes walking through the hallways up there and into that room And when he said that, I just thought, I had a sudden memory of my own children would sometimes like jump on me on the bed or bounce around. And I suddenly thought, wait a minute, I've always thought this was a very aggressive thing to do to a person, especially a guest. but if it was a child, what happens if it was playful? And it just made me think, you know what? I'm really glad I've had this experience. And I left that place quite excited. And then weirdly, I won't go into the other one, but then I got home and I had to go and visit an elderly lady in a flat, and then something weird happened there. But I won't go into that one because it's kind of private thing. But
okay, well, yeah, let me ask you about, yeah, it sounds very freaky. And the moment when it's happening to you and you're freaking out and you're really scared in the moment, I totally get.
Yeah.
Because of your religious background, did you find that you were immediately going into prayer?
No. It's weird because even though I have like this religious background, sometimes when I talk to people, they think that I'm super religious, and in many ways I'm not. And in fact, I'm very similar to many kind of agnostics that and I say this in the sense of, I'm totally open to the idea that God does not exist. I think that's completely fine. And sometimes when I say that, especially when I used to be a church minister and I would say that in the pulpit, people would be like, you're not supposed to say that. But it's like, of course it's possible. So I'm open to
that. That's not the product they're showing up to buy.
No. Well, exactly. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not a church minister anymore, because these days I'm able to, you know, work in the creative world, but I can be myself and say, look, I do lean towards, I do think there's something else. And the Christianity thing is, I'm just particularly into the whole Jesus side of it, not necessarily the religious side, but into the whole, you know, forgiving other people or like radical love and radical empathy. It's that sort of touchy-feely stuff that people can class as, oh, that's a bit wishy-washy. But I think that's the core stuff that I'm drawn to, because I think that's what the message is, rather than all these religious rituals. So yeah, I wasn't necessarily doing that. Although I've had experiences before where I've been in places where I've been a bit scared. And I remember I once just frantically found something on the television and played some kind of, you know, God channel, like on these higher numbers on kind of cable. Because, yeah, I it was when I was writing a book and I was in a haunted hotel and just something kind of strange happened there too. But yeah, all of these experiences that you have, they're strange because they're just enough to make you think, I think something happened, but they're, for me so far, they've never been fully 100% convincing to be saying without a doubt. And it's an interesting kind of mysterious place to live in.
Hey everybody, Richard Haddam here. I want to let you know that I'm setting off on my Light in the Dark Tour 2026 with an all new live show and a whole new slate of cities I've never visited before, all culminating at the 25th annual Mothman Festival in Point Pleasant, West Virginia on September 19th and 20th. I'll be there this year with Susan Lambert selling Mothman and podcast merch. And that night, Saturday the 19th, I'll be doing an exclusive performance of my podcast, an episode picked out especially for the Mothman Festival. Now, the whole week leading up to that, we'll be doing live shows in some of my favorite cities all through the Midwest, starting with Toronto, Canada, on Sunday, September 13th at the Storm Crow Manor, Toronto's nerdiest bar, and I already have my drink picked out. I'm getting the Cthulhu Tiki. It sounds insane. Then it's off to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Padraig's Brewing on Monday, September 14th. Tuesday, September 15th, we're at the extremely haunted Red Lion Pub on North Lincoln Avenue in Chicago, Illinois. Then on Wednesday the 16th, we're in Cleveland at the B-Side Liquor Lounge. And you know it's going to be fun because it's got liquor right there in the middle of the title. And Thursday the 17th, we're in Pittsburgh on the Carnegie Mellon University campus. And then it's on to the Mothman Festival. Now, you can get tickets to all shows at the Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf website, or go straight to Eventbrite and search my name and it'll take you right where you need to go. It's the Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf Light in the Dark Tour 2026. Please come out and see me do my thing. I'm happy to do it alone, but it's more fun for me if you're watching. Yeah, and also it didn't the kind of experience you had didn't inform you necessarily about the big questions. What am I trying to say? In other words, when someone has a near-death experience, that narrative tends to be pretty clear and very repeatable. And there feels like there's a message. People come away changed. It's not the same as people having experiences like the one you described, where it's like, it was really scary. I'm 99% sure it did take place in reality.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, that doesn't tell me anything about what's going to happen after I die necessarily. Yeah.
That's true. And in fact, it all it does is say, maybe all bets are off when it comes to reality. And that I find interesting. So it opens a tiny crack in the door that says, oh, through this doorway is something crazy. And that in a sense is enough to mean that when you hear these stories and you explore it, you go, I'm not just learning about the paranormal because I find the topic interesting culturally or as modern folklore. Like, I'm interested in it and hopeful that it is actually real. But you're right. It doesn't explain sort of the nature of what that paranormal reality could be. And indeed, if ghosts exist, I mean, I know that Stephen King always used to say that the idea of ghosts existing were inherently hopeful and would give you a sense of kind of hope beyond death. And I was always on his wavelength with that too. If ghosts exist, then, you know, maybe there's such a thing as eternity. But then when he was making The Shining, I think he had a phone call with Stanley Kubrick, and Kubrick had said, had challenged him on this hopeful ghost view. No, sorry, it was the other way. I'm sorry, it's the other way around. Stanley Kubrick had the hopeful view that there was ghosts meant that there's a fundamentally different story now. Stanley Kubrick said that ghosts are fundamentally hopeful. And it was Stephen King who said, well, not necessarily, because what about hell? Like, what happens if it unlocks a bad eternity?
Right.
And so I think a lot of people who tend to think ghosts are comforting sometimes don't fully think through, well, does it mean that I could possibly, when I die, endlessly repeat the worst moment of my life, let's say my death, forever in like one corridor in a hallway, you know? And that's what ghosts do. And that is actually a terrifying reality, which I do not want to be real.
I've thought about that too, because people who either through a near-death experience or when a medium contacts a spirit that, you know, has gone on, sometimes there's a narrative that kind of makes sense, where it has to do with, well, everyone has, you know, a soul. You die, you sort of rejoin, you know, just another existence on a level of pure consciousness or more just consciousness, I guess. But the thing about ghosts always makes me feel like things can still go wrong. It's like, well, if that's what you're supposed to do, and if in general it's about self-reflection and, you know, continue with these experiences, and there's this constant spiritual evolution, well, ghosts seem to be things that have fallen through the cracks. I don't see how that really plays a role in this cosmic advancement that we hear about.
Yeah, well, I think maybe it really is just that crack of the door idea of if something beyond science can happen, or beyond known science can happen, it just opens the doorway to all these other things. And I do tend to be a person who has a feeling like that we don't have separate categories of the paranormal. So it's like, oh, aliens are over here and ghosts are over here and Bigfoot's over here, and that they're all separate kind of worlds. I tend to think there must be, and religion as well as part of that. I suspect that there is some sort of unifying theory, unifying reality, which is wild, that contains all of these things. And whatever that means, whether it's some sort of weird interdimensional thing or like we, I really don't know. But I don't think we have to go like, oh, I'm an alien guy, whereas, oh, well, I'm a cryptid guy, or I'm a ghost guy. I think it's possible to be an open to everything guy.
But I love that you said that, because that's how we all grew up. We all grew up being one of those guys, because they were, again, the way we consumed those things was through a media system that separated them, and still largely does, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, you go to the bookstore, if you're lucky enough to have a bookstore that has a metaphysical section, which, you know, used to be called a cult. Now, you know, it would be. It's like, okay, over here is this stuff. Over there is ghosts. Over here are the UFOs. Yeah. And it's only recently, and with writers like Joshua Cutchin, that there seems to be a greater acceptance of, we might be talking about a realm that falls under a much bigger umbrella than we think.
Yeah. And I think, and I've written about this before, I think it has to do with the decline in organized religion, and that in some ways the paranormal is becoming a way to be religious without being religious. Because what the paranormal does, and you can compare the paranormal world with, say, the religious world, and so often they're seen as two separate things, particularly because they don't like each other, or especially Christians can give people. I mean, I've had such a hard time from certain Christians because, you know, I like, you know, ghost stories or whatever. And they'll be like, no, they're demons. And so there's this big divide between these two groups. But actually, fundamentally, they are very similar. They both have a sense that there is a hidden kind of metaphysical world that science can't fully explain yet, and it's hidden, but sometimes it gets opened up to us, and that there's this suspicion inside of both the paranormal person and the religious person that life is bigger and more wild than we possibly thought.
Well, yeah, so totally. No, but it's the Wild West, and I think that's what they're saying. I mean, in a weird way, I mean, there's so many things about organized religion that I have question with, and that maybe I don't agree with. But what's weird is that I find that almost as time goes by, I begin to understand that point of view of, look, there's stuff out there that we don't understand, but some of it ain't so great. So you really got to focus on the good stuff and don't really go looking for the bad stuff. I mean, I get that Halloween is fun and horror movies and all that stuff. Yeah. But don't spend a lot of time going, well, what'd it be like if I took a Ouija board and said, hey, Satan, are you there? It's like, don't do that. And I agree. Don't do that. Like explore, because I think that's what the paranormal, an interest in the paranormal, is about exploration in a way that organized religion is like, nope, we're inside now. We're inside this lighted place. The darkness is out. We're in here and focus on the light. Well, I kind of do believe in that. I kind of believe, focus on the light.
I agree that we should focus on the light for sure. But the problem is what we put under the category of light and darkness. That's the real kicker. And what happens, particularly with organized religion, is that it pulls in so many things that it files under darkness, which I do not think should be there. From, let's say, horror films or video games, or, you know, I did a 2-hour debate last year on radio to try and explain the woman, an ex-psychic medium, was claiming that Taylor Swift was a witch and that she was trying to kind of draw teenagers into, you know, occult and human sacrifice. Whereas I was on the other side of the debate saying, no, I just think she, you know, writes songs and sometimes she references these things. And so they draw in all of this stuff and file it under darkness and then end up creating a way of exploring the metaphysical world, which is so restrictive culturally that people are not only restrictive culturally, but also like morally, you know, like they shut down certain things. Like, we don't believe in, you know, evolution, or like you can't be gay, or you can't, like, all of these other things that they add with it. And so naturally, us as postmodern people do not resonate with that version of the spiritual quest. And so that's why you see so many people filing into the paranormal quest, because it offers the same stuff, but it does so by saying, one, feel free to test this. In fact, I encourage you to test it, you know, get out your machines and wave them around. Whether or not they're actually effective, that doesn't matter. That's not the point I'm making. It's the it gives the illusion perhaps of testing, but you wouldn't do that in a church. I think paranormal teams should be connecting with churches and saying, look, can we set up all of our equipment on a Sunday morning when you have your services and when you pray and when you have these miracle services, and just to see, does something change in the atmosphere when this stuff happens? But they don't, because churches say don't test. Whereas the paranormal want to do that, and that appeals, and there's not one set answer. The church will say, well, it's God, but it's not all of these other things. So that's why the paranormal, I think, is attractive, so attractive to the spiritual questers, if that's a word today.
Yeah, it is now. Yeah. I've always thought of the Catholics as being, on the one hand, you know, sort of extremely, you know, sin obsessed, you know, mm-hmm. and people are sinners based on all kinds of things that all of us do all the time, mm-hmm. you know, sex stuff, basically, mm-hmm. I'm talking. But then I also sort of feel like the Catholics are kind of the parapsychologists of the whole, because they kind of take it all really seriously. And they're like, you know, and so I'm wondering, in your opinion, like, what's sort of the ranking, or where does every, you know, the, you know, Catholicism, Christianity, Protestantism, I mm-hmm. mean, all the different isms that you know about, like, to what degree do they sort of go, no, it's okay, ask those questions. And the other ones say, no. How do you rank them?
Well, the Catholics are better in terms of the paranormal, because they are more open to the possibility of ghosts. And, you know, for many years, they've had, you know, writings that will say, oh, no, that it is possible to, you know, see somebody visit you who is dead. And that doesn't shock us, I suppose, because they have baked in this idea of purgatory and this like middle ground between death and heaven, that, you know, when we die, we might not be fully at the destination where we end up, or hell, or if you believe in hell, that sort of stuff. Whereas it's the Protestants, and particularly the evangelical Christians, and for them, ghosts are just a no-no, because that it's such a tight kind of framework, it can only be demonic. So for them, they would say, oh, like, whatever touched your legs that night, it could be an angel or it could be a demon, but there's absolutely no way it can be a disembodied spirit, because everyone dies once, faces judgment, and then goes to heaven or hell, and that's it. So there's a very kind of locked down version. So it is changing. I think people are becoming more open to it.
Is it changing structurally? Is it changing within, is Protestantism or evangelicalism changing?
I don't know if evangelicalism is changing, because that in some ways is locking down more to try and double down because of the kind of culture wars and that sort of stuff. So I'm not so sure, but there is there's large groups of people called ex-evangelicals who were evangelicals, but have got, you know, they have problems with the very kind of strict views on sexuality or all these sorts of things, and they move out of it. And this is what's happening with belief. It's like people are, these days, it is possible and encouraged to have your own spiritual quest in which you are in some ways the expert on it, and you can decide what you want to be. Whereas the religious quest in some ways says, well, no, the expert is the church minister or the Pope or whatever. And that just doesn't sit well with the modern mindset. And that's why so many religious people are drifting over to the paranormal. And that's why religious themes are moving into the paranormal. So people can talk about, say, cryptids. You know, in the 60s, people, when you talk about Bigfoot, it'd be like, oh, it's just a biological creature we've not met yet.
Right.
But now it could be an interdimensional being. And you read books these days about, you know, disappearing, and they could be that. UFOs in the 1950s, talk about Roswell. We'd think, oh, these are just biologics that are from a different planet. You move into the '60s and '70s, and then now it possibly might be not that they are just other beings. They may be gods, or they may even be our creators who will finally give us a purpose for being. These are religious ideas threaded into the paranormal.
Well, so, and now we get, I mean, every day it feels like we're hearing more about disclosure.
Yeah.
UFO disclosure from, is the government, does the government know something? That's A. And then B, if they do, are they going to tell us what they know? And now there's more open talk, which has always been there, that there are people in the government, and there are people all over the world who believe that aliens are demons.
Yeah.
I mean, so that falls into that darkness.
It does. Yeah. And which is depressing because it feels like anything you don't understand doesn't have to be a demon. But that does seem to be the thing that people will drag. I watched a Christian, the person who I did the debate with, actually, I still follow her on Instagram. And she was talking about how the new Minions movie, Minions and Monsters, is demonic and that has a satanic spirit. And all of these really innocuous things are flooded with evil. And that's just not the way I see the world, because I have a very positive view of humanity and a feeling that even the worst of us, somewhere in us, there is a child that got hurt maybe and has ended up like twisted because of pain, which I know sounds a bit Oprah Winfrey, but I tend to have, I'm encouraged just to have like empathy for people.
I mean, it is true. We do know of people who, because of childhood trauma, have exteriorized that trauma and have hurt other people. But so let me ask you this, because everyone draws the line somewhere. If a 13-year-old or something came up to you and was like, I want to explore the paranormal, so every night me and my friends use a Ouija board, would you say?
I mean, the Ouija boards, I made a Ouija board in woodwork at school as part of my project. They're so easy, Richard. Honestly, you just like make a kind of piece of wood, and you cut off the sides. There's a planchette. I literally used like a pen, like a biro, just to scroll on the letters. It was so crap. But anyway, somehow passed with it. But yes, a few strange things happened with that. And I ended up bringing it back in a couple of weeks' time and put it through an industrial saw, because I was like, that's freaking me out. That like it's saying when I'm gonna die and threatening all my friends. And
well, there you go. There's your darkness. So is that okay or not?
Well, what's interesting about the Ouija board is it could also be just a maligned game that really has just got the Exorcist to blame for its bad reputation, because up until The Exorcist, it was marketed as a romantic game to connect with your partner. And I did a talk on this recently about the history of the Ouija board and how, you know, it was seen as a way of kind of the mystifying oracle that you can look into, and you can have groovy times with your girlfriend because you're close to her and your knees will be touching as you're on the board. And there's this wonderful experience of, you know, asking the weird Ouija questions, and that's all it was. But it was in the early 70s when The Exorcist came out, and it was such a kind of cultural shift that it really did change people's views of what the Ouija board was. And then Parker Brothers leaned into that and started, you know, talking about it as a scary device. Is it inherently evil? That's the question.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, when the popular notion of it changed, did its nature change in lockstep with that?
Interesting. Possibly. But I sound like quite open to the Ouija board, and I am, in the sense of saying, I think it could be a cultural artifact that has taken on this kind of power. But having said that, and this is where my balance can get frustrating, I have spoken to so many people who have said a frightening haunting happens in their house after the Ouija board session. And that has been very consistent. Now, whether or not that is them opening their minds up to the concept of evil because they think the board is evil, but the board is just a nothing, you know, it's no big deal, or it's actually a doorway, I don't know. But if the 14-year-old came up and asked me about this, I would still urge caution, because even if there's no such thing as ghosts, the Ouija board has the potential to screw your head up, because I used to do it myself quite often. I do it with my friends. We do it in the school library. We do it at parties. I was like the Ouija guy. Come on, everyone. Let's down this beer and get the Ouija board out. So all the time. And I'd be playing in the background. And I brought my tape of Nightmare on Elm Street soundtrack, Charles Bernstein. Let's play that while we're doing. So, yeah, I was a bit of a handful. But I started doing it myself a lot. And the thing about that is, even if there's no such thing as the supernatural, it can be psychologically dangerous.
How so?
Because let's say if you are using it and you're using the ideomotor effect, so you're not consciously spelling out the words, it's your subconscious. But what ends up happening is you could potentially be having a conversation with your subconscious. And sometimes your subconscious may just say random stuff that you think is an actual message. And so there's times when people have done the Ouija board themselves and it will say things like, kill yourself, let's say. And
oh, you mean like AI?
Well, yes, exactly. Although, have you noticed AI is so eager to please that even if you did say something to like ChatGPT, like I'm thinking about going out and killing again, ChatGPT would be like, Peter, I love how you think outside the box. You're so original, but can I suggest that killing is not what you should do today? So it always tries to butter you up. But I think the Ouija board, I do think the Ouija board has the potential to mess with your head. And I have in this talk I did about the Ouija board, I talked about cases where, for example, there were people who used the Ouija board and it told them they were going to die when they hit 21 or something. And this poor guy was so frightened because he didn't know, well, what's the nature of my death going to be? I'm going to have to control that because I don't want to hit 21 and like, could a monster coming at me? It could be awful. So he sadly took his own life ahead of that because he didn't want to be killed in a way he didn't know. So that's what I mean by there are risks, even if it's just a cultural artifact.
A lot of you have reached out asking for help with your personal creative projects. Maybe you're writing a TV pilot or a movie. Maybe you're trying your hand at memoir. You want to tell the story of your life, kind of like this podcast. Or maybe it's a novel or a short story or a graphic novel. Whatever it is, go to richardhaddam.com and click on Richard Haddam's Writer's Room. I can read what you've got so far, help you bring it to the finish line. Or I can read a finished script or a story and help you get it into professional shape so you can finally send it out into the world. Go to richardhaddam.com, click on Richard Haddam's Writer's Room, and let's get to work. Mention that you heard about it on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf, and you'll instantly get a 20% discount, okay? Working with me isn't free, it's not even cheap, but it's worth it. Don't wait any longer. Now's the time to make your dreams come true. Get unstuck at Richard Haddam's Writer's Room at richardhaddam.com.
Well, you know, I think it gets down to the notion of intention that we touched on a couple of minutes ago, which is like, you don't want to do LSD in a situation where it might have the negative effect. Like if any of these things can go light or dark, you know, there's a lot of talk. It's like, well, you know, set and setting, you know, if you're going to use a hallucinogen, you know, or something, or a psychedelic like LSD or something like that, you've got to, you know, in a very controlled setting with very calming music and a sober person next to you. Yeah. And you're going to go into it with the intention of, you know, having a safe, positive, informative journey, something like that. And frankly, whether you're talking about a Ouija board or LSD or going to a psychic medium or just approaching your day, it comes down to what energy are you bringing to the experience, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Which you're right. That does apply to life, but it does apply to these like metaphysical quests that we're on. And so the people who the energy is, you know, there is good and evil and there is this, you know, the people out there are enemies out to get me and I'm in the spiritual battle. I'm not saying there's no such thing as a spiritual battle, but like if you're just constantly putting people in the role of enemy, you're going to view things in a very different way to what people who were open to it. By the way, I definitely don't recommend taking LSD in a non-controlled environment, because I did when I was a teenager, and that didn't work out.
God, you've done everything. I want to be you when I grow up, if I ever do grow up. Why?
Well, you know, this was all before I even considered going to church and stuff, but I was able to get some. I tried magic mushrooms a few times. But when I tried acid and LSD, I went out with my friends to a fairground because we were like, oh, all the lights, you know, that'll be cool. It'll be like, we'll see trails and that'll be fantastic. But as soon as I turned up, I was drinking a Diet Coke, and one of the women from who were like the kind of carnival people came up and for some reason just grabbed my Coke and took a swig. You know, not the biggest assault in the world. It's not a big deal if you're thinking straight. But for some reason, my brain said, everyone who works for a carnival is now against you and they're coming for you. And it just flipped into pure paranoia, which I'd been warned about, but that's why I'd never do it again. But then, so I left my friends and was just kind of wandering around town for a few hours, literally like seeing kind of stereotypical kind of carnival type, you know, with gold hoop earrings and all that, like very stereotype stuff, like looking out of windows and stuff. It was really messed up. And then I met my friend, Kevin. Kevin, I'm freaking out, you know. And then I looked down and he literally had hooves, like pan demon style hooves and like hairy legs down to like these clip-clop hooves. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think I'm cut out for this stuff. So I managed to go to a park, lay on my back, watched the sky turn pink for a while, which actually was quite pretty. And then it wore off. And I'm like, yeah, I'm done with that stuff.
Oh my God, that sounds so bad. So yeah, that would really scare me. Here's the weird thing though. When you're people who are on a psychedelic drug who have an experience or see something that other people have claimed to see while not under the influence, because people have claimed to see, you know, dog men and people with, you know, the,
yes.
So it's like, that always bugs me. Cause I'm like, oh, is it just like some weird thing that happens in your brain? But then, of course, I don't know what's triggering it with the other people. So I don't know.
Well, I mean, but you could flip that the other way and say that drugs or even certain mental health conditions or, you know, hallucinogenic kind of schizophrenia, all these sorts of things. That means it's probably just all in the brain. But the other flip side of that is to say, oh, no, these people are more open to reality. They are starting to see what's actually there. It reminds me of, you know, H.P. Lovecraft's story From Beyond and the idea that we're all surrounded by like worms and stuff, like just like slithering through us and into us and around us, and they create this machine, this resonator, to be able to see what's right there in front of us. And so the flip side is, yeah, these people who see these wild crazy things, it might be in their mind, but maybe they've unlocked a key to discover what the world's really like, which is terrifying.
Right. Well, that Michael Pollan book about, you know, how to change your mind or something.
Oh, right.
He talks about how the brain is not a radio dish, you know, that pulls things in and like the psychic among us have a larger radio dish. It's sort of the opposite metaphor that the brain is actually a filtering mechanism that keeps most of the information of the universe out so that we can hunt and procreate and eat and survive. And yet if you take LSD or other psychedelics, the theory is that filter sort of moves away and is lessened. It opens up a little bit and a little bit more comes through.
Mm. I think that's true. And it doesn't even need LSD or any other like mind altering drug to action that sort of thinking, because it can depend on even your geographic location. But what I mean by that is I have seen, you know, strange things in other people's houses, or like, you know, I haven't had loads of experiences, but I've been out and about and had odd things happen, and my mind is quite quickly able to say, hey, like that thing that happened in this house that I was in. Oh, there's a picture of this house, but I don't know if you can see it, but it's over here. No, you probably can't. If I pull out my monitor, I'll go crazy.
Of it. It looked like a haunted house.
Oh, very much so, yeah. You know, going there, that's not my house. And so I'm quite willing to categorize that as potentially paranormal because I don't live there. But some things have happened in my own house, which my brain has this habit of just forgetting them. Like, yeah. You know, I don't think I live in a haunted house at all. It's like a new build house. I just don't think I do. But yes, I've had experiences that in another house I would categorize as weird, like, you know, sitting down, hearing a huge crash from upstairs, like the cupboard had fallen over and run upstairs and, oh, there's nothing wrong. Or, and when I've been doing this, my YouTube channel, Into the Fog, I've been sharing some of this on that. A couple of weird things have been happening, like in my office, or which is where I am now. But again, I try to, in my mind, I downplay them because the implication of having something actual here is, I'm not keen. Like the thing that happened recently was I'm doing ads for sponsorships for brands and things. And I went, wait a minute, I should probably like do a one for my own books, my own novels. So I did a little sponsorship section in one of my videos recently with my novels, and I had them lined up, you know, behind me in the ad. But then anyway, I was editing the episode later, and this was only about a couple of months ago. And I heard this like smack behind me, like a very hard smack. I turned around and I thought, it must be the sound mix. I must have, I've really put that sound way too high. I'll go back and wind back and I'll drop down that slapping sound, that crashing sound or whatever. And there was no sound there. And I'm like, oh, that actually happened in reality. So I took my headphones out, turned around, and I had my four novels, and my third novel, Severed, was off the shelf. And it was off the shelf and it was that way on the floor. And it was like face up on its edge like that, which.
Weird. Like standing up like it would on a shelf.
Yeah. This isn't Severed. This is a different book I wrote, but it fell. This so looks like a book promo. And it fell like that. Just facing outwards.
That's crazy. I've had books my whole life. Never has a book fallen like that.
Exactly. Now, if I'd seen that in that house, in Quesset House, I'd be saying, that was a poltergeist thing. It could well be. Whereas this is in my own house. I'm not keen on the idea of having a pot. So my brain, like we're talking about categorizing, can say, oh, that probably could just be physics. At the same time, by the way, when I put the book back, I turned around and I saw my subwoofer, which was underneath the table, was on its side. My point is the geography of where these experiences happen can determine how high up you categorize them.
Right.
Because it can get scary if it's your own house.
And since I don't live in your house, I will say that your house is haunted.
Exactly. But imagine if that happened in your house. Where your kids live, and I don't know if they still live there, but you know, my kids still live with me, and I'm like, I love this stuff, but I don't want it in my. I want to switch off from this stuff when I'm at home.
Here's the thing, though. Your YouTube is so focused. Okay, Into the Fog is your YouTube channel, right? Yeah. And now I will expose my ignorance of how YouTube works, but that's your channel. But even within that channel, you have other sub channels or other sort of categorizations of what you do on YouTube, right?
Well, I mean, I do have a couple of channels. So I have a personal channel for just like random stuff, but Into the Fog is my kind of, I'm full time with it now. So that's my kind of show that I put on every two weeks. And that's documentaries of the paranormal. And, you know, true stories, not only like ones that maybe people may be familiar with, a lot of them, most of them people have never heard of before, especially obviously the ones that are from viewers themselves who contact me and tell their story. And I'll say, oh, well, let's have a video call with your family and back it up. See if they saw the thing you said they saw. Starting to do that more now.
And is that like all local? Is that England based?
No.
Or?
No, it's all over the place. My audience is mainly in America, which is great. So, you know, there's quite a sizable amount. I'm somehow getting like a million views a month, which is very exciting to be in that position.
God, that's fantastic. Yeah. Congratulations. I know.
Thank you. So I've gone full time with it now. I've now got an assistant that helps me. I've been able to get editing, and a historian sometimes helps out and research. It's really a wonderful experience. It literally is just presenting in-depth cinematic style experiences of the paranormal that people have been through, but it never makes stuff up. It never, you know, the stuff in there is literally what people have told me or what it says in the documents. And we really research it in depth. There's a lot of deep research that goes into this, and it seems to be going down well. It's nice to have those hauntings out there, not necessarily in my own home.
Yeah. Well, I mean, nothing, you know, a book lands on its side. That's okay. What's really weird is that your books, those novels are, I mean, that was like a paperback book, not a hardback book, right? Which makes it even stranger that it would land on its side.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Cause you can stand up a hardback a lot easier.
Yeah, if it fell and it was sort of in a V shape, it might stand up. But a paperback standing up, that's weird.
Yeah. And what's really helpful? Oh, so you go. That looked like
I was just going to say, by the way, those books are great. I mean, if any book is going to fly off the shelf and then remain standing up, it's going to be those, Matt Hunter, right?
Matt Hunter. Yeah. Yeah. An ex-church minister turned atheist professor helping the police track down Christian evangelical serial killers, something like that.
Well, there you go.
Hey, I wish they were flying off the shelves literally. And like, it's funny because when you hear somebody who shares their paranormal experience, it's so easy to go into cynical mode, and you should have a level of skepticism, of course. But what I'm learning is a lot of the slam dunk kind of arguments against these ghost experiences are not that sophisticated. So it might be, someone says, oh, my family saw this, everyone saw this, and we've got in the police, they saw it. And then they'll say, oh, and so we've written a book about it. And then instantly, like, there might be comments, oh, well, they wrote a book about it, it's made up, it's just for money.
Right.
And you're like, well, not necessarily. I mean, people who go through traumatic experiences will often want to tell their story, especially because it's so misunderstood and want other people to come and reach them. And it's such a significant part of their life. So it doesn't mean that it's made up. But even with stuff like me, like, I'm not stupid. I can tell if I was watching me saying my book, this book, and holding my own fell, I'd be like, wow, this is such an on the nose bit of book promo. And but it's not, because it's so real.
No.
And a weird thing happened, Richard, on the episode on Saturday. We did an episode about the Acton Vale poltergeist, which is this poltergeist that happened in Canada. Three priests came in for three nights running and just had lots of wild experiences. But it was all centered around a painting called Our Lady of Perpetual Help. And I didn't know anything about this painting before, but it's quite eerie because it's Jesus as a baby in the arms of Mary. But around him, there are these like little cherub angels that are holding the tools of his execution, like, you know, the nails and the spear that he's going to get stabbed with. And little Jesus is like so freaked out, like his sandals hanging off. And it's a very famous painting. And because he's run to Mary. And so Mary is like protecting Jesus from this ominous kind of symbol of his own death. So in the poltergeist, this painting is the focal point. It's like moving around the house. It's floating and going on the different walls. At one point, it's moving so much that the mother of the family puts it behind a sofa, and then it just starts like rattling like it's a caged insect, you know, trying to get out. So it's very, very freaky stuff. Anyway, so put out this episode on Saturday, and I'm like, oh, it'd be good to like tie this in with something. And I thought, oh, well, it's the 50th anniversary of The Omen, and this was said to be a diabolical haunting, so let's tie it in with that. Little did I know that when it went out, I got all these comments. It went out on Saturday. All these comments of people saying, wow, Tom, it's great that you've put this video out on the feast day of this particular painting. I'm like, what? And I was like, I'm not quite sure what a feast day is. And then sure enough, we look it up. And it turns out Our Lady of Perpetual Help has one day of the year out of 365 where it's celebrated as a painting and remembered. And no joke, I just happened to pick the one day out of those 365. And so you got all these comments saying things like, you know, Catholics, St. Mary is reaching out to you. Other people, oh my word, that possessed painting is coming for you. All that sort of stuff. But in the middle, I'm like thinking people could think this is just some clever promo because it wouldn't have been hard for me to Google that. But I'm literally telling the truth when I'm saying that that's a really freaky coincidence. Yeah. And it could be just coincidence, of course, but it's a pretty impressive hit rate at 1 out of 365.
So do you think that this stuff is going to happen to you more and more because of the, because you're spending so much time, you know, in these realms?
I wouldn't have said that, but then the weird things have happened to me have been statistically more in the last couple of years since I've been doing this. So yeah, maybe.
And how do you feel about that? Happy, sad, scared, watchful?
I used to find it all a bit scary, but and I still do a little bit, but now I'm becoming maybe a little bit excited by it. Like this, the thought that this could be real after all. And not only that, but also for the people involved, because I do really feel for those people who go through this sort of stuff. And because I know what it's like to tell a story to someone and say, oh, this happened to me, and people go, yeah, whatever. You've got a podcast about it, then obviously you're making it up. So the cynicism is just relentless. And that's only for like little things for me. These are people who say, you know, the wildest things have happened in their house, and it is really traumatic for them to, like, I get emails, Richard, from people who specifically say, please don't tell my story. Like, I don't want anyone to know this,
right.
But I've been desperate to find someone who's not going to laugh at me. And I have a feeling that you're not going to laugh at me. So can I just get it off my chest? And they'll say this stuff. And I'm like, what the heck? This is scary, yeah. Objectively paranormal stuff, you know, like beds rising in the air or like stuff beyond. It could be sleep paralysis.
It's not always people looking for attention.
It's not.
Yeah. I feel like we haven't even scratched the surface. Your books, the Frighteners, the 40 and Times, we're going to have to do this again. Will you come back again?
I would be delighted to.
All right. Excellent. Okay, great. Peter, thank you so much for joining me here, and we will talk again. All right, man.
I look forward to it. Thanks, Richard.
All right. Bye-bye.
Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producers are Tess Feifel, Sailor Franklin, and Harrison Marks. Our sound designer, editor, and engineer is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, our website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.